This episode is brought to you by Summer School Electronics. With pedals like the Snow Day Delay, the Pep Rally Fuzz, the Trash Panda, and my personal favorite, the Science Fair, which is two classic dirt pedals in one with a mid-boosted overdrive on one side, a black lab rat circuit on the other, and a blend knob to blend between them to find the perfect classic stacked dirt sound you're looking for, it's hard not to find something you'll love. Mark builds all of his pedals by hand in Syracuse, New York, where he also works as a full-time educator. In addition to the super fun graphics on their pedals, Mark also offers custom artwork. Want your dog's face on a pedal? He can do it. Want your face on a pedal? He can make that happen too. Go over to summerschoolelectronics.com and make sure to tell them that 40 Watt Podcast sent you. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 36 of the 40 Watt Podcast. My name is Philip. Good morning, afternoon, evening to you, whatever that happens to be, wherever you are. I'm really glad you're taking this time to spend with me and my guest. So at the top of the show, as we do, I'm going to take care of some housekeeping. Do me a favor, go over to 40wattpodcast.com where you can find the show notes for this episode and all of the other episodes I've done. Where you can find all the links and all the little bit of blurb about the episode if you can't seem to find them in the notes of the podcast service that you use or in the links or in the video description below. While you're surfing the internet, go over to www.linktr.ee/40wattpodcast. That's our Linktree account that has all of the links where you can find me everywhere. It has all of our social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. I don't know if I have a TikTok link up there. I'll have to fix that, but I've started doing that too because apparently I have to do all of the social media. Please follow those links, subscribe, follow, friend, whatever that service has you do to pay attention to those things. I can't keep up with them all. Y'all know how this works. Make sure you subscribe, thumbs up on YouTube if you are watching this episode on the old YouTubes. You can also find links to our Reverb affiliate link where you can go and spend the money that you're going to spend on gear anyway. And at no extra cost to you, a little bit of that money comes back to me to help make this show possible. Every little bit helps to keep me from going broke. So you can support the show that way. If you want to do a little more, you can go over to our Patreon account. That's patreon.com/40wattpodcast, where for as little as $3 a month, you can support this show and help make this content possible. For $5 a month, you can support the show, get a little bit of swag. I'll send you some stuff, some pins, some buttons. You can also get an extra episode, extra content every week. And for a little more money, we'll start sending you more things, you know, $10, $15, $20, $25, as much as you want to give. I'll send you, at some of those levels, I'll send you a t-shirt. At $50, we'll sit down every month and I'll give lessons. We will talk about guitar, bass, piano. I'll get you started on mandolin if you want. We'll talk music theory. We'll just talk life. I'll be your life coach. It'll be great. We'll have a fantastic time. I will tell you absolutely how to make everyone around you angry. It's wonderful. No, I really won't. That's what happens when I do this off the cuff, guys, and I mess up and I tell you I'm going to make people angry for you. So I'm not going to do that, but that does help make the show possible and make sure that I don't go broke making the show possible. In the meantime, you can also email me at 40wattpodcast@gmail.com. And if you have ideas, show guests or questions for me, I will get those there. We're going to move on since I have completely messed all of that up, but I'm going to say it's there anyway. It's recorded forever. This week's episode, I'm super excited to have Luthier Guitar Tech. I think people don't like the word guitar tech, but I'm going to use it. And host of the Fret Files podcast, Eric Daw. He is the head mastermind behind Pinup Custom Guitars. You really should go check those out if you haven't checked them out yet. And I've been listening to his podcast for about a year, and I think he has some really, really great perspectives on gear and vintage gear. He's gotten the chance to see some really awesome guitars and work on some awesome stuff. Also, some of the repair work Eric, I'll address you directly now. This is absolutely incredible. I'm going to bring one up as we get started. Then we'll go into how you got into this. But you did a headstock repair for a Gibson, and you did a respray of the finish, if I remember correctly, a little while back. And I saw the pictures on your Instagram, and it's, I can't tell anything ever happened to the guitar. And every time I see someone do that and the finish still looks patinaed and the finish still looks like it matches the guitar, it's like witchcraft. I don't understand it. So talk about
it. Is a little bit like witchcraft. It's hard. It can be hard to do, and it doesn't always turn out that way, you know. I mean, I aim for invisibility, but depending on the color of the paint and what happened to the wood and what I have to do to match things, my aim is to make it look as good as possible, but it's not always invisible.
Well, that one in particular was. In fact, I think the finish looked better than the finish that was on it before. It was really, I'm trying to remember. I think it was like a burgundy mist finish? I can't remember.
I did one of those. I'm just trying, I don't know which one you're talking about, because I do a lot of those. I do a lot of them, unfortunately. It's not my favorite job to do, you know, broken headstocks. Not really my favorite thing to do, but I do them.
Yeah, no, I bet they're not fun. They happen. Unfortunately, it is a thing that does happen. And that's a whole other conversation to go down, but maybe we'll talk about those later. So in the meantime, let's talk about how you got into playing guitar. Let's talk about how you got into repairing guitars, because you've been doing this for over two decades now.
Yeah. So, yeah, since the 90s. I started out, how I got started playing guitar was, as a kid, I watched a movie called The Buddy Holly Story with Gary Busey, which is a great movie. Very historically inaccurate, but really an entertaining movie. The music was good, and it was impressive. Gary Busey did all the singing and playing in that movie and did a great job of imitating Buddy Holly.
Really?
But as a kid, like 7, 8 years old, I saw this movie and just, I had never heard anything like that. This is like 1980, you know, four or something. Very different than the music that I was exposed to on the radio. And I just fell in love. And it was very guitar-oriented music, which I had not really heard much of. And it was like the heavens opened up and this ray of light came down. And this voice from above said, "Eric, you need a guitar." So I got a guitar. I asked for one for Christmas. And my dad took me down to the hardware store, which is where, I guess that's where you buy a guitar in a small town back in those days. You know, right between like the tires and the skis, they had some plastic guitars. And that's what I got this little plastic guitar, and I loved it. I learned how to play a little bit, and I think a year later I got my first electric guitar, a really cheap guitar. But I was the kind of kid who liked to take things apart. Radios, you know, interesting toys that you couldn't figure out how they worked. Like, oh, well, here's a screw. Let's remove this screw and see what happens. Sometimes I could even put the things back together. And when I got my first electric guitar, it was no different. I thought, how does this work? I was fascinated with the fact that here's this guitar and there's no battery or anything. There's a pickup under the string. And when you pluck the string, somehow it sends an electronic signal to the amp. And I thought, whoa, this is like magic.
Yeah.
I would love to understand how this works. And so, and how it does work is, you know, when the string vibrates, it creates a disturbance in the magnetic field of the pickup, right? And then sends a signal to the amp.
You know, it's funny that the Buddy Holly thing was such a thing that got you started. I saw that movie, but it's been so long ago, and I have a terrible memory for movies that I can't remember much about it. But I had a similar experience with Buddy Holly's music. So when I was a freshman in college, I worked at the Performing Arts Center on the campus of my college as a stagehand. I did audio, I did lighting, you know, and I did whatever other thing they needed me to run around and do. And we had Buddy, the Buddy Holly story, come through and perform. Oh, sure. And I worked all the setup and all the teardown, but I was really interested in it. So my boss at the time was really gracious and let me actually, I bought tickets and went and watched the show instead of working it. And it was incredible. It was a pretty elaborate setup for such a small performing arts theater. But the band played all of the music live. There was nothing canned. And so,
cool.
And it was the first real experience I had with Buddy Holly's music. And I will tell another story tangentially that I find is really interesting. I'm from Clarksdale. I've mentioned that before. And Buddy Holly's band, the Crickets, actually came through Clarksdale at some point and toured the Blues Museum there in Clarksdale. And I met them, but didn't know who they were until after the fact. Because they didn't they didn't just say, "Oh, hey, we're Buddy Holly's backing band from forever ago." You know, I just talked to them, and they were just folks who were genuinely interested in the blues and music, and they had just been through. And I went in the museum, and someone told me that's who had just came through, and I was like, "Oh,
wow. Oh man, that's cool."
Yeah, it's a weird place to grow up, Clarksdale. It really is.
Well, that's awesome.
So yeah, so you got into Buddy Holly, you got this electric guitar, you're starting to figure out how it works, and you're right, it is magic. It doesn't make sense. I realize it's magnets, electrical current, and it does make sense. But to a kid or someone who doesn't already have those notions, that doesn't make any sense.
We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported in part by Stringjoy Strings. I'm a snob, at least that's what people tell me. I'm never okay with good enough, and that's where Stringjoy Strings come in. They're better than good enough. They're the best. Stringjoy are making some of the finest strings available today right up the road from me in Nashville, Tennessee. They offer custom sets, balanced tension, coated strings, the works. If you need it, they can probably make it happen. You should be using Stringjoy Strings, and if you're going to order from them, you really could help this podcast out by clicking the affiliate link down in the description or show notes below. You get amazing strings, I get a little bit of that back to help the show keep going. It's a win-win situation. Get your Stringjoy Strings today.
Yeah, it seemed like magic to me, and, you know, even like I would take the back panel off my crappy little solid state amp and look in there, like, what are all these little parts in here? Like, you know, I didn't even know they were called capacitors. I'm like, these look like candy. Like, this looks like a chiclet. You know, what is this? These magic chiclets. And it just was a fascination, and I wanted to learn more about it. And so that hunger for electronics knowledge and guitar knowledge really fueled a lifelong passion for guitar. And this was way before the days you could just sit down at a computer and look something up easily. And so knowledge, especially this kind of esoteric knowledge, the kind that you don't learn in any kind of school when you're a kid, right? This kind of knowledge was very, very valuable. And the value of this kind of knowledge is a little bit lost now. Like, I think about a kid
group. Huh. You got your back? I think this is me. I think this isn't on you. I think this is something up with my internet, which is rare, but it does happen. Let me see if I can make this work and figure out. I'm going to go check something real fast, and I'll be right back. I really apologize for this. I know this is really inconvenient, but give me one second.
No problem.
All right, we're going to see if that stabilizes the internet a little bit.
Good. I moved even closer to my router. Maybe that'll help.
You know, I did something similar. Getting now, it's weird. Now I'm getting hearing myself through your speakers.
Uh-oh. All right.
Oh, I bet I know what it was. I bet wherever you had the phone sitting, it was reverberating off of something.
Sure. Yeah.
Yep. Because now I don't. Yeah.
Good.
I did a similar thing. I brought a signal booster in here. It's weird. I need to rethink my entire internet in this house. So let me see if I can pick us back up smoothly. So, magical chiclets and amplifiers.
Yeah. and I don't know how much of this you got, so maybe I'll just repeat myself.
Sure.
But as a kid, I would look at things like capacitors and guitar pickups, and I wanted to know how they worked. And it wasn't the kind of knowledge that you could just sit down on the internet in the 80s and Google it. It was before that time. And so... and the same goes with learning how to play guitar. Like, that knowledge was hard won, and it was hard to find out the things I wanted to find out about guitar and about electronics. And so it was like a quest, right? Where it would take me years to learn and figure out something that now a kid or anybody could learn in an afternoon.
Yeah,
with some thorough Google searching, right? And so that knowledge and the things that I was learning became so precious to me because they were hard to learn and hard to find out. And I feel fortunate that I grew up just before knowledge became cheapened in a way.
That makes right? sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the same thing happened when it got down to, I wanted to learn what makes guitars tick and how to fix them. And I found a few books about guitar repair, and they were just, it was like finding the Holy Grail. Like, wow, this has information that I've always wanted to know and couldn't find out. And, I live in a small farming town. It's not tiny, but it's a small city. And there just wasn't like any place you could go or anyone you could ask to learn how a truss rod worked or to learn guitar maintenance and setup. And it was just this quest that I set out on. And I got a little bit older, and I realized that there was a pretty decent music store here in my town that is the distributor for Ibanez guitars.
Oh, really?
They were one of the main distributors back then. They're not anymore, for Ibanez guitars. So, like, anything west of the Mississippi, any little mom and pop shop that carried Ibanez guitars, they came through Idaho Falls, Idaho. We would get semi-loads of Ibanez guitars, and they would get sent to Chesbro Music here in Idaho Falls, Idaho, and then Chesbro would store the guitars and then take orders and take out the guitars and do a little setup on each one and ship them out. So I got a job at that place when I was, I don't know, 18 or 20. Don't remember now. A lot of the stuff I had already learned through any way I could find out, you know, books that I found or experimentation on my own guitars. But they taught me even more at this place. And then they eventually moved me into the repair department. And so if anybody in the western half of the United States had a warranty issue with one of their Ibanez guitars, they would send it to Idaho Falls, Idaho, where me and one other fellow would fix it. And this was in the 90s.
That's pretty incredible.
So I've been doing guitar repair since at least, you know, the early 90s.
Yeah, it's, you know, that time period. I started playing guitar, so you're just a little older than I am. I started playing guitar, though, late in life. I started when I was 18. So in 1998, 1999, I started playing guitar. And, you know, this is, I won't call it pre-internet because, you know, it was early internet days, like early, a lot of people on the internet. You're just starting, like, it's really funny. I distinctly remember this. You're just starting to see, like, TV shows mention their website about that time, like the big shows. Right. And their website would be nothing but a page with some pictures, and that'd be about it. That would take forever to load up on your dial-up modem. You know, for the younger listeners to the podcast, back in those days, you still had to get things like books. Like, I wanted to learn how to work on amps, so I bought a book on building valve amplifiers, you know? Or you just screwed up your own stuff enough. That's how I learned to work on cars. Of course, I can't work on cars anymore. They're way too technologically advanced now for me.
Yeah.
Back then I could, you know, change a radiator. I could change a carburetor. I could clean a carburetor and put it back together. But now I don't even want to pop the hood anymore. But it was an interesting time. Now, you just pull up a YouTube video. It is an interesting thing to say when you're on YouTube and you watch somebody do it. And I don't want to say that's a bad thing. It's kind of interesting. I think I agree with what you said, though. It sort of cheapens information a little bit.
It's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing to have the kind of resources that we have now, but it's also a bit of like Pandora's box has been opened. And now, everything under the sun, you know, nothing is precious anymore.
Right.
Like if I want to learn some obscure song, I can Google it and in 20 seconds have the tablature or whatever notation, you know, the chord chart, whatever. And that was not possible when I was a kid. I had to develop my ear. I wanted to learn Jimi Hendrix's solo from The Wind Cries Mary. I had to take the cassette tape and play it and rewind it and play it and rewind it and pick out note by note. And it would take weeks to learn, you know, one little segment of a song I wanted to learn. And it in some ways I'm happy that I grew up in a time like that when it forced me to develop my ear, where I think that if I were a kid now, like, why would you do that if you could just download the tablature?
Right.
Right.
And at least have a starting point. Actually, I had this conversation with By the time this episode goes out, it'll be last week with Linda Taylor, who's an LA-based guitarist. And she was talking about growing up and learning to play and having to pick, you know, learn things that way, where now tablatures out there, or we talked about she learned very on reading music. So she's always read music, yeah, like from day one. And she said she wishes she had spent more time even learning by ear than learning to read music. And I mentioned, because I've done both, I learned by ear first, then I went and got a music degree from college, so I learned to read music. By the way, I don't recommend learning to read music while you're getting a music degree. You should probably learn to read music before you get there. But I did it while I was there.
Yeah.
And it's, even in that music, people like to dog out tablature because it's very amateur driven. And you were talking about that whole, that we're in what someone referred to once, and I love this term, the age of amateur.
Yeah.
Everyone can be an amateur anything because they can pull up how to do it on the internet. And yeah, it's really interesting. But even in the sheet music would be wrong sometimes. So you still, like, there's still, sure, a value on ear, like listen to it. And even when you pull up that music, you'll go, you know what? That's not right. It's just, I'm going to play it the way it is on the record. Or sometimes it's just something that's impossible to notate. It's like this, yeah, this thing happened. There's no notation for that. I think you've referenced Hound Dog Taylor before on your podcast, and I love Hound Dog Taylor. I would not want to try to notate his music.
No, it's not that kind of music, is it? Yeah, and that's what I like in, you know, the performance is very different than the black and white that, you know, you put it on paper. The same thing with, like, I listen to a lot of blues, like harmonica players like Little Walter, you know.
Yeah.
And there's so much happening there, and there's so much nuance and so much in the phrasing that you could play the notes he played, but it would be very hard to make it sound like he made it sound, even though you're playing the same notes. And it has to do with the phrasing and the tone and sometimes the, you know, the timing and slurring certain things together. It's very nuanced. And that's the kind of thing that developing your ear will tell you, where that maybe learning how to read music necessarily won't, but they're both valuable. I can't read music, but.
Oh, I'm bad at it. So don't let me fool you. I can do it. I'm terrible at it. I'd much rather listen to it. And yeah, I pull up tabs too when I'm learning a new song, like I'm playing in this cover band, and they're, hey, we want to play this song. And I'm like, I don't know how to, I've never heard this song. You know, I don't listen to top 40 radio. And so I go and I pull up the tab, and then I listen to the song, and I'm like, oh, well, this tab's wrong. Or, oh, it gave me a jumping off point. I get the idea now. I can listen to it and figure it out. And sometimes it just saves me a little bit of time. But I think you've got to do both. It's sad, the players that can't pick things out by ear. I'm not great at it. I wish I'd only done by ear. I think I'd be a lot better at it. But, you know, I'm old now, and I don't have that much time in my life. So you got into repairing guitars. You're working on Ibanez guitars, which is an interesting way to look at it. You know, in the early mid 90s. So think about, yeah, Ibanez in that time period. You're working on all the super shredders and the Floyd Roses.
Very pointy guitars.
Yeah,
pointy with monkey grips and extra strings and whatnot. Not my scene, but very well made guitars and fun to work on. You know. Fun to learn on, you know, and I had no problem with Ibanez guitars, but it's not my scene.
Right. No, I don't have a problem with them. I actually occasionally find myself having this weird moment of, man, I wish I had an RG550. I don't know why I want a shred guitar. I don't know, but it's like, I feel like it'd be a interesting thing to have every now and again. So you're in Idaho Falls. How'd you end up in Seattle?
I just reached a point in Idaho Falls where I needed to get out, and it was a multitude of things, but it was, just, you know, things going on in my personal life that I just, it felt like I was at a dead end. And I met this young lady who I chased to Seattle. And it's as simple as that, you know? And I had this skill. I could work on guitars. And really, my hope was to get into playing music over there, because I was gigging here in Idaho Falls and not making a ton of money. But I thought, man, if I can do this in Idaho, that I could make a killing in Seattle, not knowing that in Seattle, you're lucky if they even pay you. There's so many musicians and so many bands waiting for the same gigs, and they'll have, you know, five bands in a night and your set is 35 minutes. And, you know, here in Idaho Falls, I was playing 5-hour blues gigs. Different scene. Anyway, yeah, make a long story short.
I'm so tired of 4-hour gigs. I'm so tired of them.
So I didn't really, I played a little music over there, but really what happened is I got a job at Emerald City Guitars in Seattle, which is a great vintage, one of the premier vintage shops in the country. And I got a job as their in-house guitar tech luthier guy. And I worked there for about 15 years.
So you're there at, again, a premier vintage place. So this is a place where you're starting to see some real pieces come through. You're not, you know, you're not working on like an RG250 that somebody sent back because the Floyd Rose wasn't installed correctly. You know?
Yeah. And I had seen some vintage guitars before that, because it was an interest that I had. And so I would seek them out and people would seek me out to work on them. But, working there at Emerald City, it was a routine. I would work on 50s Fenders and Gibsons and 60s, you know, Gretsch and Rickenbacker, all kinds of, you know, you name it. And I remember the first time I worked on a late 50s Les Paul Sunburst, set it on my bench, and I thought, you know, this thing is worth more than the house I'm living in right now. Like, don't slip. Don't hold your screwdriver very carefully. You don't want to put a $30,000 scratch in this guitar.
Yeah.
It's very kind of nerve wracking. But then I thought, you know what? It's just a guitar. How many guitars have you fixed? You know what you're doing. Just a guitar. But it's definitely a different level to work on guitars that are worth that much money. And you can certainly mess them up by doing the wrong thing. And so you have to be cognizant of being a good steward of these instruments that are going to be around a lot longer than we are. You don't want to do things to mess them up, because they're valuable and they always will be.
So I shouldn't route a 59 Les Paul for a B bender is what I'm hearing.
That's correct. That's correct. And I had no problem telling people, because I would get requests, you know, people saying, hey, will you do this to my vintage Fender? And I'd say, no, I'm sorry, I won't.
Yeah. That's an interesting place to be, is to be at that point in, first of all, you know, not a lot of careers where people can pick and choose that kind of work. You know, sometimes you're beholden to what work comes your way, but you know, you're working in a premier shop, so you have no shortage of work coming through that needs to be done. So you get to say no. And it's, I don't have a problem with people experimenting with guitars. I don't want anyone to ever think that I don't want people to do really cool things, but there's the right instrument to do it to, and there's the wrong instrument to do it to.
That's right. Yeah. And there was a time when people weren't thinking about that. I see a lot of guitars that were ruined in the 70s.
Yeah.
And who cared? You could buy a 50s Telecaster for $300, $200 in the 70s. That's just an old guitar nobody cared about, you know? But now they're worth way more than that, you know? So you have to be careful.
Yeah, and some of those butchered ones are the only one we normal folk can afford anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
I see a lot of I see a lot of on Instagram and YouTube, I see a lot of luthiers and repair technicians having to take some of those guitars and, you know, fill in routes that somebody decided to do, or, you know, try to somehow get the somebody. Again, I always harp on the Floyd Rose. Y'all, I don't hate Floyd Rose tremolos. They're just not my thing. They're also really, really invasive to install. So I use them as an example. Routing out some of those vintage Strats and guitars from the 70s and 80s, where people started adding like crazy tremolo systems to guitars that shouldn't have had them to begin with. And they're trying to fill it in. They're trying to make it look original. Or there's a guy, another guy on Instagram I follow, JW Restoration, I think is.
Yeah, I follow him too.
Yeah, he's working on a crazy gold top repair where like the entire seat of the neck has been completely, I don't know what happened to it. Yeah. So you're seeing some of these crazy work where people are trying to reverse that kind of stuff and trying to fix what was done in that era where people didn't understand the instruments that they were, that they were really, I don't know, hacking up. Did you have to do a lot of that work when you were at Emerald City, fixing those kind of hack jobs?
I did a fair amount of it. I got into finish work and, you know, refinishing, respraying, spraying lacquer, doing touch up work, putting new fingerboards on or repairing truss rods or, you know, kind of the neck resets on vintage acoustic guitars, kind of the more hairy end of guitar repairs. And what happened, you know, part of this pursuit of knowledge that started when I was a kid, it continued on when podcasts became a thing. One of the first things I did as podcasts started getting popular, I noticed that some of the podcasts were about pretty esoteric stuff, like stuff that wouldn't be on commercial radio, all kinds of topics. And I thought, I bet there's some good podcasts about guitar repair. And there wasn't at the time. And so eventually I started one, and I've been doing that podcast for going on, I think, 8 years, 7 or 8 years. And it was slow going at first. And really, I just thought it'd be fun. I wasn't thinking about it advancing my career in any way. I kind of liked the storytelling aspect of talk radio and thought it'd be fun to do a podcast. So I started doing this podcast. Well, it wasn't long before people started sending me guitars from all over the country. People that were listening to the show saying, I want you to restore this, you know, because I've listened to your podcast and you know what you're talking about. Yeah. So it reached a point where after doing the podcast for several years and after living in Seattle for so long, I really didn't want to be there anymore. I'm not a city guy. I didn't like to be in the big city. And my wife and I had started a family. We have two little boys. And I wanted to move back to Idaho and live in small town America. And the podcast enabled me to do that because I had a larger clientele and I had people shipping me guitars, and I realized, well, it doesn't matter where I am now.
Right.
If people are going to ship guitars, I can live anywhere I want. So I moved back to Idaho, and about a third of my business is people shipping guitars to me. And another third of my business is local repairs. And the other third of my business is the custom guitars that I make. And so between all that, I'm able to make it happen. It's pretty fun working from home, and I'm pretty happy about where I'm at.
Yeah. So at what point did it transition from just repairing guitars to building your own? Because you like legit build your own. Like there's some guys who build their own. The parts caster things become a popular thing. And a lot of people are doing that. They're having somebody else make the necks, or maybe they're only, you know, finishing the bodies. And I've seen a lot of that around. You started building your own, and you're doing it very much at, you know, from listening to your podcast, you're very much in that vintage spec, that vintage, you know, your wheelhouse. You're not trying to do everything. So when did that become what you wanted to do?
Yeah, 15 years ago, I think I started doing that. But I don't want to mislead anybody. I can make necks and bodies from scratch. Most of my guitars they're cut on a CNC machine, and they're, they're parts casters. I don't want to mislead anybody.
Well, I don't want to, I also don't want to, but at this point we don't need to, I've gotten to a point now with CNC machines that there's nothing, it still comes down to the person doing it. Cause it's a machine. Yes. But if it's machined right and the right person handles it after, I don't think that's any less handmade. I'm going to use some air quotes here. Because someone's hands still have to touch that neck or that body to get it to the place it needs to be. You're just letting someone else do the majority of the big taking off.
The heavy lifting. Yeah. So I let, I don't have a CNC machine on site here. So the parts are cut, by different suppliers, and they're supplied to me kind of in rough form. And then I finish them, I shape them how I want, do all the contours and do all the finishing. And there's a lot of the things, a lot of the aspects of the guitars that I do make, like I make my own pickups.
I was going to ask you about that later.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's been fun because I couldn't find a supplier who would make the pickups how I wanted them to be made. So I started making my own, and that's really been one of the greatest parts of making guitars was trying to decode the magic of how I want the pickups to sound.
Yeah, I've watched pickup winding is something I'm really, really fascinated by. I've been a long time. I was on the Seymour Duncan user group for a lot of years. They have a forum where guys talk, and Seymour Duncan occasionally showed up over there. But it was a really small, tight-knit group. And because it was a forum, it's all about all guitar, but because it was founded around a particular pickup maker, a lot of the conversations happened around pickups. And you'd hear things they would talk about MJ over at Seymour Duncan, who is one of their master pickup makers. And they talk about the winding process. And I got really, really deep into that. And I've always thought that if I got into building something myself, pickups were something I was really fascinated in. I think there's untapped, awesome things. And so you build your own. I saw where Zach from Mythos Pedals is starting to wind his own pickups now as well. He's in the very beginning stages. Was that difficult to get into?
Yeah, it was. The first pickup I wound, I didn't have a pickup winder. So what do I have that's even close to that? Well, I have a record player. So 78 RPM, built a pickup bobbin and wound it on a record player. And I think it took like an hour and a half.
That's awesome though.
And I thought, well, this is slow going because really, with a high RPM motor, I now I can wind a pickup in maybe 15 minutes. I built a few prototype pickup winders. I tried a record player. I tried rigging up a hand drill with a little mounting plate for a pickup bobbin and wound them that way. And eventually just made my own pickup wounder out of parts that I scavenged off of a sewing machine. So it's basically made out of sewing machine parts with the pedal controlling the speed.
Yeah.
And it's all, the wire is all fed by hand.
That seems like the logical, repurposed item appliance to pick up winding. It doesn't sound like the first time I've heard someone go with the sewing machine, but it does feel like, I can't remember who else may have said it, but it just feels logical. Of course, now you can go to Stumac and buy a pickup winding machine if you want to.
Buy a pickup winder.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. And I'm sure it's a really nice pickup winder. One of the things I like about my pickup winder is I saw online a picture of, there's two old pickup winders I saw online pictures of that are now in, you know, museums. Leo Fender's original prototype pickup winder from his early days looks almost identical to mine. And I didn't know that, you know, till I saw it. And I thought, well, that's good.
You're onto something.
Why not just stick with that, you know? And then the other one that looks almost identical is Seth Lover's pickup winder from his workbench in the 50s. And I thought, I'm in good company here. I'm just going to stick with this rather than get a shiny red new pickup winder with a digital counter. I'm going to stick with my repurposed sewing machine motor because it works.
Yeah.
And I'm familiar with how it works, and I have a counter on there, and all the little parts that I've added to it, I added them so I know exactly what's going on with it. So if something breaks, I know how to fix it, because I put it together. So I like my little pickup winder, and hopefully that motor never burns out, because I want to wind pickups on that motor forever. It's an old motor. It's like from the 30s.
Oh, wow.
Little electric motor. Yeah.
See, and that's, I have this conversation with people all the time nowadays, especially, where a new machine, shiny and bright, does the job. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Someone can take that machine and probably wind a pickup just as good a quality as anybody else making on any other thing they're doing, if they know what they're doing. But there's a vibe. Sure. You do something with something you love, and there's something that feels the end product may mean nothing more to the end user, but to the person making it, it means more. I think the same way about certain guitars and certain amps or certain things that I just like playing and I like doing. Sure. This guitar I'm playing is beat up. It's 25 years old. It's got this one issue right here where I know I can't really do this, but I love playing this guitar. I could get another guitar that plays better, air quotes again, but I don't enjoy it. It doesn't bring me joy. I just recently sold a Helix rig. Cause I went that route cause I was playing church and musical and choir gigs and stuff like that. And I just recently sold it because ultimately, did it sound pretty good? Yeah, I'm not going to lie. It sounded good. I got some great sounds out of it. I didn't love playing it.
Yeah.
You know, nothing about it felt good to play. And so, same thing.
Yeah, I could get a lot nicer guitar than this. This is my favorite acoustic. This was $14 at a thrift store.
Oh, that's came awesome. With
these little swan decals that already had them on there, but it didn't have a bridge. I had to find an old bridge, and I didn't have a pick guard. I put the pick guard on, but this is an old K acoustic guitar, and it was $14. And I love the way it sounds, and I love the way it plays. Could I get a nicer guitar? Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure. If I wanted to spend the money and get even a vintage Gibson or Martin, it would be a better guitar for sure. But the mojo that this one has, it's just so enjoyable. I like the way it sounds. It's kind of boxy, and I play a lot of on acoustic, I play a lot of fingerstyle blues and stuff, and it's just perfect for that. So,
I've talked about him on the podcast before. I'm going to have to end up getting him on the podcast, but I have a friend of mine, Ronnie, owns a music store in Clarksdale where I'm from. And he has almost built he doesn't carry, there's no brand he carries. He's not a dealer for anybody. You know what I mean? He's a small town, mostly secondhand store, mostly consignment store. So you never know what's going to be in his shop. But one thing that he has done consistently is buy up every K or Silvertone or that Archtop or acoustic that he can find. He works as best magic he can as a guitar tech to try to get it playable, to make it usable. And then he sells them. And are they the best playing, best sounding guitars in his shop? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The secondhand Takaminis and the secondhand, like, X Series Martin that's in the shop plays better. Maybe technically sounds better, but are they cooler? Hell no, they're not cooler. And so what sells? The arch tops and the K's and the, you know, all those old guitars that just have this energy. They have a vibe. And
yeah,
it's a different thing.
I'm a big fan of this, like what I call the second tier vintage American made guitars, because the Fenders, the Gibsons, the Martins, the Gretches, they're just out of my price range. You know, I mean, I suppose I could probably buy one if I wanted, but then it's like a liability. Like I have this guitar that's worth $30,000. Like where am I even going to put that? Under my bed?
Yeah, know? Exactly.
In a bank vault. So, so I love to buy K, Harmony, Dan Electro, Silvertone, Regal. I have a couple vintage parlor guitars that are Washburn parlor guitars.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, almost all, you know, because Washburn, now you think of them as like the, an Asian made kind of, you know, middle of the road.
Right.
Budget acoustic, but Washburn made excellent guitars 100 years ago.
There's a reason it was Washburn that had I'm gonna get this wrong. Didn't they have a Wes Montgomery signature at one point? Or did they, was it George Benson?
I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe
one of those.
Maybe the modern Washburn.
Yeah. And it was like,
yeah.
And it's because, you know, that older legacy of Washburn, everybody forgets they've been around for a long, long, long time as a brand, not making the same style guitars.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So I love the second tier vintage stuff because it's affordable. I can buy a great American made guitar, usually with a Brazilian rosewood fingerboard, for under a grand, you know, most of the time. And you just can't even come close to that with the top tier stuff.
No, not at all. I was at Summer NAMM in Nashville a few weeks ago, and I went over to Carter Vintage, and I filmed, and I still haven't put that video up. I need to do it. They were gracious enough to let me film a little bit with, they had a 1960 Burst Les Paul, and I looked at the price tag, and it's like $325,000. I've never touched a single item that I could hold in both hands that was worth that much money. You know?
No,
it's crazy. more than my house. It's more than, you know.
Yeah.
It's completely ridiculous. And we're talking the most extreme, like 59 and 60 Burst Les Pauls. They are the extreme without any provenance. You know, you just add artist owned or played and it gets different, but those are so out of reach for normal people that now I do worry that second tier is going to start to go that way now. It's like, because the other stuff is so out of reach. Yeah. We're seeing 80s Fender Strats and Telecasters and Gibson stuff start to get into ridiculous numbers too.
It's funny to think about an 80s guitar as a vintage guitar, but I guess it is now.
Yeah, it's 40 years old-ish. It's crazy. Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, and the good news is with old Harmonies and things like that is they made a billion of them. I mean, Harmony, I've read that Harmony made more guitars than all the other American manufacturers put together.
Oh, man.
And so because they just made so many of them, I don't think they'll ever have a huge premium on them because the factors, I mean, I understand why a 1959 Gibson Les Paul costs as much as it does, even though I don't agree to pay that.
Right.
I understand why it costs that much. Demand, rarity, and what's the other factor? I talk about this all the time because people ask, like, why?
Right.
Is that guitar $300,000 and this one that looks just like it $3,000?
Yeah.
You know.
condition, rarity, and demand.
Yep.
A guitar that has those three things, if it's in good condition, if it's exceedingly rare, and there's a big demand for that instrument, then that's the magic combination. And the thing about vintage harmonies is the rarity. You just don't have that.
Yeah.
Because they made so many.
And that, that extends to, see, I love the K, the flat tops, you know, the ones I'm talking about with like the really crazy looking, like orange and black stripy finish, the acoustic guitars. I don't know the proper term for it, but I love those, and I've played more of them than I can count, you know, hanging out in my friend, my buddy Ronnie's shop, because he had so many come through, and I've played them in every version of playability too. I've played some that it doesn't make sense. It plays so good. And I've played some that I could fit a screwdriver between the strings and the fingerboard. You know what I mean? It's but my favorites are the arch tops. Some of those K and those, you know, the million other brand names that they went under, depending on what store was selling them. But
Old Craftsman.
Yeah. Craftsman. Oh, was it the Craftsman has the Zippo pickups? Oh, I've played a few of those that I can't believe I didn't buy them. This is where I have a terrible memory for brand for model names. I think it was Speed something.
Speed Demon.
Ah, that's what it is. It's got to be that one. Speed Demon. They're such cool guitars, but I've always been a sucker for arch tops because I love that style of music, the blues and the jazz that were played on them. I don't have one currently, and I need to get one, but they have that vibe, and you're right. There are a million of them out there. Otherwise, Ronnie wouldn't continue to be able to find more and more to fix up, and he can buy them so cheap because there are a million of them. And occasionally, you know, he gets one. He's like, I can't make this play. Like, there's nothing I can do to make this playable. This is a wall hanger.
Yeah.
And he sells it as a wall hanger, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I love those old guitars. And so getting down that road, because I really want to talk about some of the blues stuff you're into, because I get a lot of people on this podcast. I don't often get to talk to people who are as into the blues as you are. So you also, I want to tell our listeners, your love of classic things isn't just 1930s sewing machines and 1950s guitars. You have like an old school Oldsmobile with a Rocket 88, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, 52 Oldsmobile. I took a little drive in it this morning.
Oh, see, I have a lot of kinship to that song, Rocket 88. Maybe the first rock and roll song. You know, we're not going to go way down the we're not going to go way down that rabbit hole, but I'm a public librarian. That's what I do. I'm public library director. And Jackie Brinston, who was a saxophonist who sang Rocket 88, he was an avid goer of the library in my hometown in Clarksdale. And it's probably a really great point to end on, actually, as I have taken up a great deal of your Saturday afternoon already at this point.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Me too. We battled technology issues and everything. We got through. We're here. And I could honestly talk about the whole blue side of things all day, and I actually have this idea for a podcast separate from this one where I want to start deep diving on the history of blues and take like performers, songwriters, and do like deep introspective looks into their history, how they got where they were, how they influenced other things, and sort of follow the history of the blues through the years. It's going to be a major project if I can actually make it happen.
That would be very cool. I would listen.
Yeah. I'm thinking I've already started the sketching out of the timeline of the first season. So I'm hoping to actually start writing with some earnesty later this year. Cool. And so next year, maybe get something out, but we will see. In the meantime, Eric, thank you for your time. I'm going to have all the links where people can find you down below. Y'all check out Pinup Custom Guitars. Check out Eric's band. I'm gonna put the Instagram for his band down there as well, and for his Instagram account. We will see you next week, same time, here at 40 Watt Podcast. But until then, y'all be sure to take care of yourselves, be kind to each other, and make some noise. This episode is brought to you by the supporters of 40 Watt Podcast over on Patreon. Go over to patreon.com/40wattpodcast, where for as little as $3 per month, you can help support the podcast and get every episode ad-free. For $5 a month, you'll get every episode ad-free, as well as a bonus episode every week. I can't overstate how thankful I am for the support of my patrons, and hope you'll consider joining the team and helping keep this show on the road.